This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Today, authorities in Boston have begun to dismantle some of the tents in an sprawling encampment that has become a makeshift home for people experiencing homelessness and mental health issues and addiction. This follows acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey's order that the tents at the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard in the South End pose unacceptable risks to public health and have to come down. Here's what Governor Charlie Baker had to say about this afternoon.
The end game here should be to do all we possibly can to find those folks a level of support and treatment and housing that makes sense for them. It's no one thing that's going to work here. There's a whole bunch of things that have to get dealt with.
WBUR senior correspondent Deb Becker has been on this story for us and joins us now. Deb, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the people who've been living in this encampment. What are they being told today? Just pack up and leave?
Well, what I'm told is that Boston Public Health Commission workers are giving people storage bins to pack up their belongings. And this effort seems to be focused today on just six tents near Theodore Glynn Way. The workers are telling people in the tents that they can go to area shelters, but they don't have to. One business owner said the moving of these tents today was so workers could access the area to put up lighting. And the city just issued a statement within the past hour saying that these cleanups today are for scheduled building maintenance. The statement says the city is working on a procedure to follow the mayor's executive order for removing the encampment, and it says no one will be asked to move without first being offered shelter.
All right. Now, Deb, you talked to Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins, and he's put forth a plan to provide treatment and beds for people in a now vacant building at his jail. I understand that you toured the facility recently. What's the status of that plan now, and what are people saying about it?
Well, the sheriff says the plan's moving forward and quickly. He expects it to be running by Thanksgiving. He's renovating space at his jail for a makeshift courtroom that will be in the jail and an addiction treatment facility. He says people with outstanding criminal warrants would be processed in the courtroom at the jail, and then the courts would decide if those people would be eligible for treatment at the sheriff's addiction treatment facility. His office estimates that about 135 people living on the streets of the Mass and Cass area have outstanding warrants, and the treatment facility that he envisions would hold up to 100 men and women for up to 90 days.
All right. Deb Becker, stand by. I'm going to come back to you later in the break. I'd love you to stand by and listen to a couple more perspectives on this very important story. Let's turn now to Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, who joins us on the phone. D.A. Rollins, welcome back to Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start. You heard Deb Becker talking about Sheriff Tompkins' plan to set up a temporary court and treatment center at the Suffolk County Jail. Good idea?
Well, I think only idea. I think most people in the room that have now had daily almost meetings about these issues recognize that the sheriff is the only person that's presented an option that is potentially viable. Remember, what we're dealing with is an incredibly medically compromised population that is in need of acute care often with either psychiatrists or medical staff, as well as housing navigators. We need specialists and we need them right in that area. We are going to the heart of the problem to try to come up with a solution.
Right. So how would this work legally? Or let me ask the question this way. Aren't there legal issues around taking people off the streets, people who haven't been convicted of a crime, and essentially housing them in a jail? I mean, can you talk a little bit about that and the issues, the complicated issues around that question?
So we thankfully have the criminal defense bar sitting in these meetings now. Anthony Benedetti is an excellent lawyer. He represents CPCS. We have the attorney general in these meetings, as well as the governor of our commonwealth, the mayor of the city of Boston. And we have advocates. We have really smart and exceptionally crafty, which I'm proud of, advocates that are going to make sure that whatever is proposed by the city of Boston is going to be lawful. And there have been some challenges to proceedings, not specifically this one, but there are lawsuits that have been pending regarding individuals being housed in carceral facilities when they have medical issues, right? So right. We need to be careful with respect to that. I can tell you that with respect to any of the warrants that people have in that area, if there is a makeshift court, that will only be done with the approval of Chief Justice Carey and Chief Justice Ronquillo, who are respectively the Chief Justice of the Trial Court of Massachusetts and the Chief Justice of the Boston Municipal Court. So this isn't, you know, a fake court that the sheriff is creating. There will be judges that have been, you know, vetted through the Judicial Nominating Commission, appointed by the governor or nominated by the governor and approved by the governor's council. There are real judges. There will be real criminal defense attorneys. There will be real prosecutors.
I get it. And I understand the safeguards as you've described them, and they make a lot of sense. But what do you say to the critics who worry that this effectively criminalizes addiction and homelessness by forcing folks into a jail setting for treatment?
I agree with them. If I could choose a location, it would not be this location. What I am saying is nobody is proposing a different solution.
Got it.
We are dealing with the most medically compromised population that you could imagine. If you have actually walked in this area, if you have walked down Bradston Street, onto South Bay Ave, Atkinson, Topeka, Cummings, Moore, Southampton, all of those streets, you are seeing humans living in squalor. There are sexual assaults happening. There's human waste in the streets. There is violence. There are fires that are happening in tents. What I want is a location where they can be stabilized medically if need be. And of course, we do have Boston Medical Center right there. But also, we need to come up with a solution to stop the harm that is happening in that area. And again, I agree with you. If the Greater Boston Food Bank or Winston Flowers had said, hey, we have a space and we have a medical facility as well and staff, we would be looking there. But
I got it.
A, that's not there, you know. It isn't something they have to offer. And ideally, I just want to have something right in that location so we can start getting the assistance that people need, a central coordinating structure, so that hopefully nobody is even going in for any legal issues, but we're getting them the housing stabilization they need, the medical treatment they might need, the services, the detox, the stabilization, housing, all of those things with a central coordinating structure is what we're hoping happens.
D.A. Rollins, I'm going to let you go because I know we've got a hard stop with you, but I just want to ask one final quick question. How, in your view, did the situation at Mass and Cass, this sprawling encampment of tents and makeshift shelters where the homeless and addicted ended up, how did this come to be? And what does it say about how America in the 21st century is dealing or not dealing with these issues?
I think it, specifically in Boston and in Suffolk County, we can look at the closing of the Long Island Bridge as the beginning of a lot of what happened. I don't believe we had a solution to that emergency. Mm. And I will be clear, I do believe it was an emergency that the structure was failing and we cared enough to not have people risk their safety going there. But we needed a plan B, a plan C, a plan D. And I believe we've just put too many services in a very small location. Suffolk County and Boston in particular are bearing the weight of our entire Commonwealth and quite frankly, all of New England, where all of these facilities that are there to assist are within too small of a radius. When we think about even medicinal marijuana or recreational marijuana, there are buffer zones for marijuana distilleries or dispensaries, right? We don't have any buffer zones. We need to spread out the assistance throughout our Commonwealth, and we need to make sure that we are providing people with an actual alternative. a place where they can lay their head with dignity and respect, a place where they can go to detox or get the treatment and help that they desperately need. And I'm proud that we have the Department of Mental Health, the Department of Public Health, the City of Boston, our governor, and many other really important people at the table to try to come up with a holistic solution that is not just carceral.
Right. And it sounds like it's going to take every one of those people at the table to resolve this. That's Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. DA Rollins, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Be well.
All right. Same to you. Let's go to Sarah Wakeman now. She's the medical director for substance use disorder at Mass General Brigham and an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Wakeman, good to have you back on Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've been listening along. I've got some specific questions about Sheriff Tompkins' plan and about what's going on there. But what did you hear from DA Rollins that struck you, that you agreed with or disagreed with? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, first, I respect DA Rollins immensely for her work on trying to decriminalize some of the ways that we have criminalized addiction in the past. And I agree with her as well that full stop, a correctional setting, is the last place that we should be putting an addiction treatment center or something that we're calling addiction treatment. And I think her comments about finding places where people can be safe and have shelter and be treated with dignity and respect are absolutely accurate. And so I think it's more in how do we actually do that and what are the strategies forward.
Right. Now, I know you've been critical of Sheriff Tompkins' plan to treat people experiencing addiction at his jail. Tompkins says he's forced to act because all other health providers and leaders are not acting. Here's a bit of what he said.
We have no choice. I refuse to walk out of here and see somebody dead. And I don't want that at our doorstep. I just don't want it. I'm not having it.
And Dr. Wakeman, we heard DA Rollins sort of making that same point. It's the only choice, apparently. What's your response to that? Is that true? Is it, at this point, the only choice we have?
Well, I think first I respect the passion and concern, and I share that tremendously for the safety and well-being of our community members. And the fact that people are stepping up to try to do something, I think, is laudable. I think the problem is that we need to do things that are actually effective. And the idea of putting people in compulsory treatment or jail-based treatment settings has been studied. It's been done in many places across the world, and the outcomes are terrible. And so I really worry that this effort that is meant to be one of helping and of sort of intervening and offering something will actually increase harm and increase death.
Mm. So in your opinion, what's the number one thing the city should be doing right now to help the folks at Mass and CAS?
Well, I think this is part of the challenge, is that it's not one single thing. I think often with these very complex crises that develop and grow over time, we want sort of a single silver bullet that's going to fix the problem. And the reality is these are complicated humanitarian crises. And, you know, the intersection of addiction and houselessness and mental illness, poverty, structural barriers, and intentional policies have really resulted in what we're seeing in the Mass and CAS area of Boston. But the important thing is that there are effective interventions for each of those issues that exist, and they don't include compulsory detention in a jail or a jail-based facility. So if we think about what is effective, it's really expanding immediate access to voluntary, welcoming, effective, and evidence-based addiction treatment through sustained investment across the entire Commonwealth. We've heard about sort of the need to have services everywhere, not just in certain areas. We know that harm reduction absolutely works to prevent overdose death and help people keep stay safe and stay alive. And so we could continue to push for legislation around safe consumption sites, continue to support public health interventions like syringe service programs and overdose education and naloxone distribution, drug checking. And then importantly, if we don't address the housing issues and access to non-congregate shelter for temporary housing and then longer-term housing where there are tremendous systemic barriers, even with our focus on housing first, we're not going to solve this crisis.
Right. Now, those make a lot of sense to me. At the same time, they're longer-term solutions to this crisis. And it seems like the acting mayor, Steve Tompkins, and what we heard D.A. Rollins sort of talking about was, what are we going to do about these people today? And so I guess this gets back to an interesting question. I think you mentioned what the research says about the efficacy of involuntary treatment or, compelling people to go into a jail-like setting to get treatment. What does the research say about that?
Yeah, well, first, just to respond to the urgency, which I absolutely agree, but, you know, it comes to mind as a older doctor when I was training who trained us that the acute finding of a chronic problem doesn't make it an acute problem. These are chronic issues, and they absolutely have solutions, but we need to be thoughtful about the solutions, and I think the rush to an immediate sort of broad intervention that could actually be very harmful is not the right approach. And so when we think about what the research shows, you know, there have been a couple different ways this has been looked at. So in Massachusetts, there's some observational data that people who have gone to involuntary treatment through the Section 35 process have a higher risk of fatal overdose than people who voluntarily go to treatment. Now, you could say that sort of maybe those people who are going to Section 35 are different than those who are going to voluntary treatment, and we can't answer that with the data that we have, but it's concerning nonetheless. But there have been studies, for example, in other countries and in much of Southeast Asia, the idea of compulsory drug treatment was a norm. These compulsory drug treatment centers were very common, and researchers actually did a prospective observational study as the country was rolling out voluntary access to treatment with things like medications that we know now are the gold standard for opioid use disorder, and they were able to compare outcomes in those two groups. And people who were forced into compulsory treatment, the average time to relapse or recurrence of use was about a month, whereas those who went into voluntary long-term treatment with things like medications and counseling, the average time to recurrence of use was about a year. So dramatic differences in terms of outcomes. And then lastly, we can look at what are called meta-analyses, where people look at all the research that's been done on these types of models and really see that there's no conclusive evidence that they're helpful, and there's actually concerning evidence that they can be very harmful.
All right. I want to ask you finally, Dr. Wakeman, before I let you go, the final question that I asked D.A. Rollins, and just the idea that what happened, what made this this sprawling encampment of tents and makeshift shelters, what made this happen? I mean, what have we, what are we not doing, I guess, in 21st century Boston or not dealing with that we should be dealing with?
Yeah, I think, again, there's no one single thing. I think starting by humanizing the people who are suffering from this and not treating them, you know, as something, as an eyesore that needs to be removed from sight, but rather as complex humans that have dealt with trauma and need help and compassion and dignity. I think, you know, there have been efforts to really push people into one single area, and so I think that has led to sort of a congregation of people in a certain place. But then as a society and as a city and a state, access to affordable housing is tremendously hard. We have systemic barriers, even for people who can navigate the complicated pathway into housing, that if you have a criminal record, in some cases, you can't get housing. So we've made a lot of choices as a society to really criminalize and punish certain members of society and leave people with very little other than the people around them, their community, who are trying to keep one another safe. So I think undoing that really requires rolling back all of those things, ending the war on drugs, really asking people what they need and being willing to meet those needs, including access to housing, to health care, to social services, and most of all, the compassion and dignity.
All right, Dr. Sarah Wakeman, she's the medical director for substance use disorder at Massachusetts General Brigham and an associate professor at Harvard Med School. Dr. Wakeman, thanks so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
And still with us is Deb Becker, WBUR senior correspondent. Deb, jump in any way you want, but what strikes you about what you heard, both from Dr. Wakeman and from D.A. Rollins, about this situation at Mass and Cass?
Well, I think that D.A. Rollins' comments about the fact that this would be a program, that Sheriff Tompkins' program would be a program that would be approved by the trial court and is the only option on the table is certainly one way of looking at it. But I think that it's a quick option. And Dr. Wakeman's comments about the quick option maybe not necessarily being the best, I think, is also something that folks might want to consider because Sheriff Tompkins says he's going to have this program up and running by Thanksgiving. He believes he will be able to have it running. He'll have a courtroom, and it's full steam ahead for his particular program. I'm not necessarily sure that it will be the solution, but yes, he has the most concrete plan on the table right now to deal with this sprawling encampment that everyone agrees is a humanitarian crisis in the city of Boston. Mm.
Final question, Deb. There's a big storm headed our way this week, which has me wondering, where will people go? What options do they have right now for shelter?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Boston officials say that there are about 170 beds open on a daily basis at area shelters, but many people have been banned from shelters or they don't meet the criteria for a shelter placement. And there, the estimates are there are about 150 tents in that area of the city. Typically, they're occupied by more than one person. So it's really not clear where everyone would go. It's a huge problem. There have been fires reported in the tents as people try to stay warm. That's likely to increase as it gets colder. It's a dangerous situation, and it's not good for anybody. But right now, there's not enough shelter space in Greater Boston for all of the people who are staying there.
Oh, boy. Well, that's WBUR senior correspondent Deb Becker, who's been tracking and following the situation at Mass and Cass for us. Deb, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The situation at Mass and Cass, along with housing, transportation, and education, are at the heart of Boston's mayoral campaign. And we're going to talk a little bit about that now. With just 8 days to go until Election Day, the two candidates, city councilors Michelle Wu and Anissa Sibey George, meet tonight in their final debate. It's co-hosted by WBUR, the Boston Globe, the McCormick Graduate School at UMass Boston, and WCVB Channel 5. And it may be a Sibey George's last and best shot at shaking up the race, in which Wu appears to have a commanding lead, according to recent polls. Joining me now for a preview of tonight's debate and the final week of this historic race is Boston Globe political reporter Emma Platoff. Emma, welcome back to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Emma, let's start with tonight's debate. What are you expecting?
Well, as you said, we're getting really close to Election Day here. We know that early voting has already started over the weekend, and every poll we've seen shows Michelle Wu with a really tough to beat lead, you know, 30, 32 points, 25 points, numbers that you really don't want to see if you're Anissa as Sibey George. So the burden is on her tonight. If she doesn't shake up the race at the debate or with the other events she's doing in the final stretch here, the race is going to be hers to lose, I think. And we've seen her come out swinging more and more in recent weeks, particularly at the debate last week, really hammering Michelle Wu on plans that she says are unrealistic, going after some things in her personal life as well. I think we can expect to see a sharper and more aggressive tone from the underdog in the race tonight.
Yeah, interesting. So put yourself in the campaign war rooms. Do you think advisors to Anissa Sibey George are telling her more of the same? As you mentioned, we saw her get pretty aggressive and feisty in that last debate. You think there's going to be more of that tonight?
I think there is going to be more of that. And the polls actually bear that out as a strategy. Even folks we surveyed in our poll, the Globe did with Suffolk University, even among likely voters who said they do support Michelle Wu, there was a lot of people who were impressed with Anissa's performance in the debate. They said she performed unexpectedly well. This is a format that plays to her strategy. She's a strong communicator. She really connects with people one-on-one. And so I think she's going to try to make as much of it as she can.
What about Michelle Wu? She's the front runner. What are you expecting from her?
I think when you're in the front, your chief mandate is do no harm, right?
Right.
You want to avoid landmines. You don't want to mess up. You don't want to put your foot in your mouth. You'd rather take as few risks as you can. You know, you'd rather try to stay above it all. And that's the tone we saw Michelle Wu strike last week when Councillor Sibey George went after her on a number of things. Michelle Wu kind of took a step back and said, listen, I think the people of Boston deserve a better race than this. They don't deserve to hear these personal attacks. And it's smart positioning if you're in the front. You know, you have no reason to get into the mudslinging if you think you're ahead.
I want to ask you about sort of how we're characterizing this race beyond the mudslinging in these debates. I mean, Michelle Wu has this sweeping agenda that includes free public transportation, universal pre-K, a Green New Deal, while Anissa Sibey George focuses, I guess, more on education, safe neighborhoods. In that last debate, she talked about the importance of filling potholes and sort of, you know, attending to the more prosaic things of city government. But it's been characterized as a contest between a progressive and a moderate. Does that oversimplify it in your view? How do you sort of characterize these two candidates and contrast them?
It's a neat narrative. I think, you know, in politics, almost every narrative is too simple,
yeah,
right? If you were to really dig into where these candidates fall on every issue on education and transit, there are a lot of places where they sound really similar. But I think where we see the differences, where we see these labels like moderate and progressive start to emerge is in rhetoric and in style. And if you look at the way they've acted on the city council over the past few years, and even in the way they campaign, you see that they strike very different tones. And I think that's where the sort of narrative that's emerged around the race is fair.
We've said this a lot, but it bears repeating. This race is historic. Two women, both of whom identify as people of color. One of them will become mayor, the first time that Boston will elect someone who is not a white man in over 200 years. So no matter what, it reflects a huge sea change in Boston politics. But do you think that the race itself, the tone of the race, the debate between these two candidates reflects the issues that folks in Boston are passionate about? Is that coming through?
I think it's hard to know how engaged people are. We at the Globe certainly have this approach as well. This is such a historic race. No matter who wins, Boston will be making history. But when you look at the really disappointingly low turnout numbers from the September preliminary election, and a lot of folks I talk to are predicting similarly low turnout on November 2nd, it's hard to say how much are people really being reached. You know, are people as excited and as engaged by this historic election as we thought they might be? Or do they see this as a foregone conclusion with a Mayor Michelle Wu and there's just no need to get involved? Or do they feel that neither candidate is speaking to their issues? So I think that's a question we can answer more with the turnout numbers next week.
It'll be interesting to watch. You've been covering this race from the start. What are you most interested in as we enter this final week of this campaign? What are you going to be looking for?
Well, the final battle in the final few days here is really among voters of color and in particularly in Black neighborhoods. We know that the candidates who did the best with Black voters, Acting Mayor Kim Janey and City Councilor Andrea Campbell, were eliminated from the race in the September preliminary stage. So where do those voters go? A lot of the strong endorsements from communities of color have broken for Michelle Wu. Do the voters follow those politicians? That sometimes is the case, it isn't always the case. And certainly we see that in the last few weeks, that's where both candidates are really, really fighting for support, trying to earn Black voters' support. So that is one of the places we'll be really interested to see where things shake out.
Interesting to watch. Last question, Emma. After we mark this historic moment in this city's history next week, what's the biggest challenge awaiting the next mayor of Boston, whoever she is?
Well, it's worth mentioning, of course, that whoever becomes the next mayor will take over November 16th. There's not sort of the several month runway that you would typically have. And so we're talking to candidates already about what does your transition plan look like? You have 2 weeks basically to turn around from running a campaign to running the city of Boston. The issues that they'll confront are myriad. It's hard to even say what would be the top priority. I mean, both are talking about education, city schools. That's certainly a priority. Just a few moments ago on this program, you were talking about the opioid crisis at Mass and Cass. That's a problem that whoever is elected mayor will inherit. So there's no shortage of challenges awaiting her.
Big challenges and not a leisurely interregnum to take them on. That's Emma Platoff, political reporter for the Boston Globe. Emma, thanks so much. Thanks for giving us your time. It was great having you.